Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 2. Shortly after Howard the kitten joined Callie's menagerie, she stood surveying the contents of her small California house. The harder and longer she worked, the more unsettled her life seemed. As if to support that analysis, Bernice and Venus suddenly pricked up their ears and ran frantically. Even though Callie knew what to expect, the quake hit before she had time to brace herself. Books flew through the air like heat-seeking missiles, and she barely had snatched a languorous Howard off the windowsill before reproductive anomalies and dairy cows shot by and shattered the glass. When the quake ended, many of Callie's lighter belongings lay scattered about her, but that and the broken window were the extent of the damage. While she took stock, Howard meandered through her possessions and assumed his accustomed position in front of the television as if nothing unusual had occurred. Venus and Bernice didn't share his attitude. It took Callie more than 3 hours to coax them out from behind the refrigerator. While she was cleaning the behind-the-fridge fuzz off Bernice's feet, a police officer appeared at her kitchen door. "Are you Kalita Shackelford?" he asked, in that tone used by bearers of bad news. Callie automatically grabbed Venus and held both her and Bernice before she nodded. "Dead?" she numbly echoed after he informed her of her parents' deaths. "How can they both be dead?" "I don't know any details except they were found in their car, presumably dead of carbon monoxide poisoning." The officer shrugged his shoulders apologetically. Callie hugged Bernice and Venus so hard they yowled. Howard glanced briefly in their direction, then went back to staring at the blank screen. Within 24 hours, Callie had kenneled the cats, flown to Boston, rented a car, and driven to Addison, thereby depleting her meager savings. When she arrived in town shortly after 9 a.m, she stopped at Alexander, a.k.a. Penn, Pennington's Addison Granary, where she'd worked as a kid. Even though Penn's stock of farm animal feed had long ago given way to premium pet foods, an upscale collection of tourist bait, and building and gardening supplies, Penn himself hadn't changed a bit. With his round, cheerful face, bushy hair, short, bandy legs, and bright clothing, he looked like a garden gnome someone had shaved and put on a low-fat diet. His wiry 70-year-old body could heave 50-pound sacks as effortlessly now as when Callie was a child. His dark brown eyes, beneath their valance of gristly gray brows, still didn't miss a thing. "Morning, Callie. How's life?" Penn greeted her as he always did when she entered his store. "Not too good," she answered. "What happened?" "The day before they did it, your mom arranged for Billy Paradise to come to the house and give her a hand in the morning. When he got there, he found them." Penn gave her the basics in the same no-nonsense manner she remembered so well. "Billy found them?" The very idea of it stunned her. According to local lore, deaf-mute Billy Paradise had the mind of a 5-year-old and a body the same age as Callie's. As 3-year-olds, the two of them first met in nursery school, where his mother sent him to gain social skills, and Bernice sent Callie to get rid of her. Although even then both adults and children noticed that there was something wrong with Billy, Callie wasn't among them. In her mind, the only thing wrong with Billy was that he was different, because she already was beginning to sense that there was something different about her and her family, too. She never saw this as a problem. At first, Callie tried to teach Billy the basics of reading and writing, but after he labored so hard to master his own name, hers, and the numbers from 1 to 10, she abandoned that approach. Instead, the two of them developed a system of looks and hand signals to communicate in that special way of young children, unhampered by the limits of words. Once they did that, they managed to say whatever they needed to each other. Billy loved animals as much as Callie did, and everywhere he went, his big black dog, Nana, went with him, another plus for Billy as far as she was concerned. Not surprisingly, Bernice and Howard had no interest in animals, and, prior to meeting Billy, Callie had spent many frustrating hours trying to catch a variety of creatures to tame and keep as pets. But because she only had Bernice's pace to lure them, she had no luck whatsoever. Billy changed all that. His mother made him wonderful lunches with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, fruit, homemade cookies, and all kinds of other delicacies guaranteed to entice all kinds of wildlife. not because Callie wanted it, but because Billy insisted. They always freed their animate treasures after they'd watched them eat Billy's lunch and explore their cardboard shoeboxes for a while. As she clutched a shoebox with its wondrous residence to her chest, he would hold up his hand with his fingers together and the palm facing her. Then slowly he would spread his fingers, their sign for let go. Ultimately, she would capitulate, but she never lost the desire to hang on. After Callie went to the regional junior high and high school, she didn't see much of Billy. While she studied science and math, he learned the basic skills that would later enable him to live alone with support from the townspeople who looked after him after his folks died. The bulk of Addison's residents did not consider Billy retarded, impaired, disabled, or any of the other politically correct labels that came and went over the years. Billy was just Billy, an amalgam of childlike innocence and curiosity, blended with basic handyman skills and more than 40 years' immersion in the daily life of the town and its inhabitants. The day before she left for college, Callie saw Billy and Nana on the nearby beach where she'd fled in an attempt to get away from her parents and her conflicting thoughts about her future. As she clambered over the rocks, the contrast of Nana's glossy black coat and Billy's downy white hair as he bent over the dog near the water's edge caught her eye immediately. Someone said a chemical balance had caused Billy's brown hair to turn white, but she didn't think anyone ever really knew that for sure. Neither Billy nor Callie planned to meet, but it didn't surprise them when they did. They spent the day as they had so many others, lying prone, staring into tide pools, or walking the beach looking for unusual shells or signs of life. In those few hours of silent gestures and looks, they shared more than she'd shared with her parents her entire life. When it came time to go, Callie found a rare patch of sand on the otherwise rock-strewn graveled beach and stomped a small heart in it with her sneakers. "I love you, Billy." He cocked his head and nodded in a very specific way, his way of saying, "Yes, I know." Setting up Billy to find their bodies was a despicable thing for Callie's parents to do. "What did Billy do when he found them?" Callie asked Penn after quickly processing all those thoughts. "He called Joe McDermott, the new wood guy." "The new wood guy? What happened to the old one?" "He died, Callie. He was 92. To Callie, it seemed like only yesterday that the old wood guy turned 80. But why were they talking about wood guys in the first place? "Why did Billy call the new wood guy?" she asked, although it was a toss-up whether to ask that or how her deaf-mute friend could call anyone. "Joe's also the new chief of police." "The chief of police? When did we get a police force?" "A few years back, when Donnie Duty got busted for smoking pot at Yale. His folks funded the position to keep other youngins from going astray." The influx of increasingly bizarre information made Callie feel a little lightheaded, and she leaned against a bale of peat moss for support. The woolen mill Duties were the only people in town whose offspring could afford or would dare to do drugs. It seemed unlikely that any other young residents would go astray, now that the Duties' only child was either in jail or at Yale. "Joe's out cutting wood, but he wanted me to call him when you got here," Penn announced as he picked up the phone. His way of telling her he had no intention of further discussing the Duties' recent foray into subsidized law enforcement. He then retreated a discreet distance and conducted a conversation with a man Callie envisioned somewhere in the woods, armed with a cell phone, a chainsaw, and a gun. She did not find this a comforting image. "Joe wants you to go over to Getz's funeral home and make any arrangements you need to," Penn reported without establishing eye contact when he finished his call. "He'll meet you at your folks' place at noon." Joe McDermott shut off his cell phone and picked up his chainsaw. He did not look forward to meeting Callie Shackelford under any circumstances, let alone the ones that mandated meeting her now. In the 4 years since he'd moved to Addison, he'd made the acquaintance of both her parents, as much as anyone could, which in and of itself stifled any desire he might have had to meet their daughter. He found Howard and Bernice both bland and hardly worth a second glance. However, that same Shackelford blandness functioned as Addison's tabula rasa, onto which the townspeople projected the full range of human idiosyncrasies, from benign eccentricity to full-blown madness, and thereby gained the entire family a mystique they most certainly would not have gained otherwise. As a result, Joe never clearly grasped who or what the Shackelfords were, and the circumstances surrounding Howard and Bernice's death did nothing to clarify that image. And smack in the middle of this from the beginning stood the one person who could set the record straight, but couldn't or wouldn't for some reason. Billy Paradise. Joe had seen a lot in his life, but the sight of Billy casually leaning against the car containing the bodies of Howard and Bernice Shackelford left him almost as shaken as the two events had moved to Addison to escape. In an attempt to ward off memories of those past events, he immediately immersed himself in his law enforcement duties. First, he analyzed Billy's demeanor, seeking clues to what happened and why. When that failed to provide any insight into the Shackelfords' death, he attempted to interrogate Billy using the personalized sign language he and Billy had developed. But Billy just smiled, the sanctity of the strange bond that led him to steadfastly honor the privacy of the Shackelfords impervious to challenge. Everyone in Addison knew the special relationship that also existed between Billy and Callie, and Joe had heard about that, too, at various social gatherings. However, what then sounded like mere gossip to add spice to otherwise dull conversation now took on new meaning. He now saw her as the only person in whom Billy would confide, and his only chance of learning the details of her parents' death. But for all the talk about the special bond between Billy and Callie, he never heard anything about the relationship between the Shackelfords and their only child. Surely that, too, must play a role in how they chose to kill themselves and how much she would share with him. Such thoughts of parents, children, and death released more unbidden memories from his own past. In an effort to abort them, he seized the starter cord and yanked his chainsaw into life. No, thought Joe McDermott, setting the spinning chain against the smooth gray bark of a sturdy oak, I do not look forward to meeting Callie Shackelford at all. Callie made her way to Addison's only funeral home, thinking about Chucky Getz. In addition to being a whiny crybaby, Chucky used to wet his pants, and she had hated him since the first grade when she sat down in a seat he'd just vacated during a game of musical chairs. It didn't surprise her in the least that he'd become a mortician like his father and taken over the family business. Chucky's funeral home reminded her of him, dark, kind of creepy, and a little damp. This has been such a terrible shock for everyone, Chucky murmured as he led her into the bowels of the building. He opened a large cooler and rolled out two gurneys with his still chubby but now overly manicured hands. Your folks always were kind of queer ducks, Callie, he then announced as she stood staring in the chill that radiated from her parents' bodies. Is that what passes for sympathetic condolences in the funeral industry these days, Chucky? She finally asked when she could tear her eyes away from her parents' remains. Well, no, but you gotta admit. His voice trailed off as he examined the lapel of his slightly too snug Brooks Brothers suit, checking for lint. Admit what? That her mother was wearing a man's tuxedo, spiked heels, and a brass bra befitting a Nordic goddess, while her father sported a grotesque orange wig, a silky floral housecoat, and hunting boots? Hardly likely. A small plastic bag containing two kitchen utensils lay at Bernice's feet. The wire whisk. And the spatula, I don't understand, she stammered, forcing herself to focus on the normalcy represented by the objects rather than her parents' outrageous appearance. Nobody understands, Chucky commiserated, holding the plastic bag up for further scrutiny. They were on the dashboard. Oh, what else could she say? About the arrangements, Callie, I can give you a good price on matching coffins, a nice service in my eternal rest chapel, plus burial in a town cemetery. Chucky easily dropped into his commercial appeal, but the way he leered at her gave Callie the same gross feeling she had when she sat on his wet chair in the first grade. Forget it, Chucky, she declared firmly as she clutched the utensils and fumbled through her wallet for her MasterCard. Cremate them. Together. When Callie arrived at her parents' later that morning, an old gray cat sat on the side porch, wearing a patient expression that reminded her of Gwendolyn Murray, the old gray-haired woman who owned the farm between the Shackelfords and the beach. Mrs. Murray, always a Mrs., never Ms., should tell everyone, would routinely arrive bearing gifts of fruit and vegetables from her garden. Bernice would always insist on paying the old woman and then keep her sitting on the porch while she first found her purse and then second agonized, Bernice's favorite word, over how much to pay her. After Mrs. Murray left, Bernice would feel so overwhelmed by her neighbor's thoughtfulness that she'd agonize for days over the ideal recipe to celebrate the special offering. Inevitably, the fruit or vegetables would rot before she made up her mind. Mrs. Murray lived a long and full life, Callie pointed out to Gwendolyn, the newly christened cat now rubbing Callie's ankles with her head. I expect you to do likewise. Like many rural New England dwellings, the Shackelfords' house consisted of a small, two-storied cave with a single-storied connector to the barn. 10 years previously, her parents first noticed a stray gray cat in the barn, where she lived off mice and her wits. During the decade they lived with the animal, Callie's parents never felt any inclination to pay any attention to her at all, let alone name her. Their daughter succumbed to the need to name the cat almost immediately. Callie opened the door and invited Gwendolyn into the house. Much to her surprise, the cat accepted. Inside, the kitchen appeared as cheerless as Callie remembered it. The only evidence that someone had lived there took the form of two clean cups and a drying rack next to the sink, and a thick, sealed envelope bearing Callie's name on the kitchen table. She ignored the envelope and walked through the house with the cat, opening the windows as she went to let in fresh air. Even though Callie had returned home for a brief visit 2 years previously, everything looked alien and empty to her. When she opened the closet, she suddenly realized why. Bernice and Howard had removed all traces of their presence. No clothing hung in the closets, no undergarments, scarves, or gloves filled the drawers of the dresser and the bureau. No photos or papers filled the desk or decorated the furnishings. No personal objects, not even a toothbrush, remained in the bathroom. Fascinated in a macabre way, Callie went through the entire house and barn, seeking any intimate evidence of her parents. She found nothing except the envelope on the kitchen table, with her name written on it in Bernice's flowery script. They must have spent weeks cleaning the place out, she told the cat, remembering her parents' pack rat tendencies. Then she sat down at the kitchen table and opened the thick envelope in hopes its contents would tell her why. Well, Gwen, here's the deal, Callie finally announced after she read the opening of the long letter Bernice had placed in the envelope along with some legal documents. Except that there's nothing personal of theirs in it. It's all mine, including a hefty amount Bernice inherited from her brother George last year. Just saying George's name exposed a familiar small black hole in the universe of Callie's psyche, but she ignored it. The old wood guy, her parents, George. It seemed like everyone she knew had died without telling her. She turned her attention back to the letter, then once again summed up its contents for the cat. You're not going to believe this, she forewarned Gwendolyn, who was methodically grooming herself. Bernice said that a new life began for her and Howard when he found a patch of marijuana growing in the back field, and she started adding it to their food. She refers to what follows as the Enlightenment. Gwendolyn paused in her ablutions long enough to give Callie a quizzical look, which inspired her to explain further. She says she recognized marijuana right away because of the time she spent with Lester. Callie paused momentarily to ponder whether Lester was A, the guru her mother ran off with, and B, her real father, and decided she didn't want to know. Instead, she continued her summation to the cat. Bernice and Howard agonized, what else, over whether to call the police and report the illegal crop. Howard thought they should, but Bernice said they couldn't because Addison had no police. Not true, Callie then exclaimed to the cat, getting caught up in the cadence of Bernice's copious exclamation points. Thanks to the duties, Addison does. Then it hit her that Donnie Duty probably planted that patch of forbidden foliage, thinking her parents would never notice it or wouldn't recognize it if they did. The irony that this adolescent escapade by the son of one of the town's most elite residents should inadvertently precipitate the unusual death of two of its most nondescript ones did not escape Callie. By the time Bernice and Howard finished agonizing, the marijuana had dried and she started adding it to their food. Just as a joke! Bernice then devoted several pages to a description of the miraculous transformation that occurred in their lives, including a detailed account of covering herself with Dream Whip and having oral sex with Howard in the bathtub. After that, all the time your father spent working in the mill and I spent tending my iris seemed like such a waste, Callie read Bernice's summation aloud to the cat. So he decided to go out with a bang. Still reeling from the idea that her mother had had oral sex with her father in the bathtub, let alone that she had actually tended those pathetic iris all those years, Callie next read Bernice's meticulous account of how she and Howard spent all of their free time going through the house, removing anything that might remind her of them. I did keep my favorite spatula and wire whisk with me because I had so much fun baking that last day. But everything else is gone. We didn't want to leave anything that would make you sad, Bernice concluded. Callie put the letter down and stared at the emptiness around her, the tears streaming down her face. It didn't work, Mom, she said. A sound behind her caused Callie to whip around, too startled to wipe her tears. Billy Paradise stood in the kitchen doorway, holding a bouquet of wild flowers in his massive hand. She barely curled her index finger. Come in. He entered and subliminally shrugged his shoulders. I'm sorry. Are you all right? She wiped her tears with her sleeve and smiled. I'm fine. Billy peered at her and then at the flowers, his blue eyes clouding with concentration, the light breeze through the open window ruffling his downy white hair just enough to make him look like a large, lost albatross chick. He held out the flowers. For you. She took them and hugged him. Thanks. Then Callie heard a hesitant cough and noticed a figure standing on the porch. A man emerged from the shadows and introduced himself through the screen door as Joe McDermott, Addison's new part-time police officer. For a moment, Callie felt as mute as Billy. The two men could have been brothers, same large frame, same blue eyes. McDermott's hair was brown, streaked with gray, and his eyes lacked that faraway expression, but still. No, we're not related, Joe McDermott declared as he entered the kitchen, knowing from her expression exactly what went through her mind because he'd heard remarks about his resemblance to Billy many times since his arrival. He also could see it himself. I didn't know Billy until I bought my place and inherited him as a tenant. He gave her a somewhat wry smile, then soberly added, I'm sorry about what happened. Callie acknowledged his remark, then immediately addressed the subject she suspected would interest a police officer the most. From what I've seen in the house and read, she paused long enough to gesture toward the pile of papers on the table. They'd been planning to do it for a long time. Any idea why? According to the letter from my mother, they wanted to do something exciting once in their lives. Christ, you would have thought running off with a swami was enough. He wasn't a swami, she corrected him somewhat irritably. According to Bernice, well, Venus, he was a guru, probably named Lester. Venus? Who the hell is Venus? Bernice, my mother, but only when she was drinking and dancing through the house, but maybe all of the time at the end. I can't tell. No shit, McDermott steadied her. You sure about that? I lived with it, her, them. On and off, and as much as they'd allow, until I left for college. Gwendolyn brushed against Callie's leg, so startling her that she shuddered in surprise. To cover her embarrassment, she jumped up, picked up one of the cups next to the sink, and filled it with water for Billy's flowers. Was Billy all right when you found them? She changed the subject. Where does my folks were? It's hard to believe they'd set him up like that. You know, Billy, life and death don't mean the same to him. Joe smiled at Billy when he made that observation. What are you going to do now? Heading back to L.A. as soon as I can find someone to look after the house. Aren't you having a funeral or memorial service? Don't you think my parents have supplied the town with enough entertainment already? I wasn't thinking about them. I was thinking about you. If you're talking about closure, she told him as she neatly refolded Bernice's letter and tucked it back into the envelope, I don't think I'm going to find that until I get as far away from here as I can. Joe McDermott wanted to tell Callie that it wasn't right not to have some kind of a service, but then he decided that he couldn't just tell a stranger something like that, nor could he tell her that she didn't look at all the way he expected her to look, even though that thought was uppermost in his mind, too. He'd expected her to look like her mother, whom he got to know as much as anyone when he plowed the Shackelfords' driveway each winter. No matter how bad the weather, she would come out and wait for him to make the final pass with the plow, then pay him. He'd see her at the end of the driveway in her heavy black coat with the collar turned up, obscuring all but her wild red hair and green eyes, an exotic, delicate flower in an obsidian vase, who would murmur a shy, "thank you," when she offered the money, as if he had done her some great favor by plowing her driveway at the going rate. But Callie stood facing him semi-defiantly, much stronger and darker than her mother, her thick hair framing her face and her large red-rimmed gray eyes calmly staring into his. Suddenly what he knew about her, or thought he knew, made him feel very uncomfortable, like a voyeur. He hated that feeling, not because of what it said about him, but because it gave her an emotional charge he found disturbing. Since his divorce, Joe had reduced women to the basics, tits, ass, whether he'd like to have sex with them. As far as he was concerned, Callie Shackelford had nice tits and a nice ass, and he would like to have sex with her. Why the hell should he care whether she had a memorial service for her parents and found closure in that or any other activity? What the hell did he know about closure anyway? That he even considered this bothered him so much, he abruptly asked her the question commonly asked of those who had a second home in the area. Do you want Billy and me to take care of the place for you? To demote her from a resident to a visitor. Callie accepted the offer, then added, would you mind picking up my parents' ashes from Chucky Getz and bringing them back to the house when they're ready? They may be a little heavy because of Bernice's bra. Two comments that only increased his belief that Callie Shackelford could not go back to California soon enough. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.